Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded August 23rd, 2023. Last week, the 2023 Freedom Flotilla Coalition vessel Handala ended the first leg of its two-year journey to the besieged Gaza Strip. The Handala follows a string of attempts to open up Gaza to the sea going back to 2009. The most infamous of those was the 2010 convoy, attacked by the Israeli military at a cost of dozens shot and 10 lives lost. Rifat Adeh is a longtime activist for and defender of Palestinian human rights. A Palestinian-Canadian, Rifat studied engineering in Canada and media and journalism in Great Britain. His articles are published by numerous outlets online in English and Arabic. Rifat was aboard the flagship vessel Mavi Marmara when commandos descended, and his multi-award-winning documentary film The Truth Lost at Sea is the account of the 2010 Freedom Flotilla and Israel's lethal attack against it. Rifat Adeh in the first half. And the struggle to save what remains of first-growth forests in Vancouver Island continues. The 2021-22 partial blockade of timber company Teal Jones at Ferry Creek in the Cowichan region resumed late last month. And last week, three more defenders joined the 1,200 arrested last year, trying to stop logging there. The arrests bring the issue back into public consciousness, even as the trees continue to fall. Molly Murphy is a BIPOC activist, journalist, researcher, and social justice warrior. She's one of the 1,200 people arrested at the Ferry Creek protests and continues to fight against the systems of oppression and supporting those who strive to do the same. Molly is also a builder, mother of three, and co-author of the Mud Girls Manifesto. Molly Murphy and Standing Still for Ferry Creek's Old Growth Forest in the second half. But first, Rifat Adeh and keeping the story of Gaza and the martyrs of the Mavi Marmara alive. Well, welcome to the show, Rifat.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
Well, Rifat, yesterday in the village of Beita near Hebron in Palestine's West Bank, Ahmed Ralab al-Jaoub was shot down by Israeli soldiers. At least it's presumed right now that it was a soldier's bullet and not a settler's that laid him low. Before getting to your shooting at the hands of Israel's military, are you following the story of Ahmed and what happened to him just yesterday?
Well, actually, I saw it on a video, ironically, a video of an Israeli organization. It's an Israeli human rights organization. And I saw the moment that he was shot. And it's tragic, but unfortunately not surprising, because Israel has constantly and consistently shot civilians in the past, even journalists who are clearly marked as being journalists with press vests, and it's an unfortunate situation. I don't think that anything will result from this in regards to holding the perpetrators accountable, especially if they're Israeli soldiers, because they usually get away with killing Palestinians with impunity, unfortunately.
Well, you know, what really struck me, and when you mentioned journalists being shot, of course, Shireen Abu Akla, and everybody forgive my terrible pronunciation, but she, a journalist for Al Jazeera, a Palestinian American, if I remember rightly, was killed last year. Just as you described, she was wearing press, you know, big press markings, a bulletproof vest and helmet, and was absolutely intentionally murdered while she was covering demonstrations in the West Bank in Janina,
yes. If I remember. Yes, that's correct. And, you know, when she was shot, at the time, the Israelis initially denied it being one of their soldiers. And then they went on to say, well, there's a possibility it could have been one of the soldiers. And they kept on changing their stories again and again. And it was very clear that she was shot by a sniper, an Israeli sniper. And, you know, investigations have been done by Al Jazeera and other entities, third parties, and they all indicate that it was a deliberate killing by an Israeli sniper. So, again, that's a good example that you brought up. Nobody was held accountable for her killing, and actually Israeli officials said that they will not try any of their soldiers on numerous occasions in the past when these things have happened.
Well, impunity, of course, is key to this this behavior continuing and this project by the Israelis, I would argue. And part of that is to make it very clear to people that would shed light on what they're doing, because it is so blatantly illegal and morally repugnant, that they would target people that tell the stories, journalists that show the pictures, and even the people that are charged with aiding those wounded, which was the case when this young guy was shot yesterday. He was going to the aid of another person that had been shot down.
In regards to the killing of this young man, as you said, he was going to basically assist somebody who was already wounded, somebody who was already injured. And this reminds me of also what used to take place in Gaza during the Great March of Return. At the time, there were people who were protesting at the Gazan border, including, young men and women, children, elderly, etc. And there were medics there, paramedics, who were there in order to assist the people who were getting injured. And even the paramedics were being shot at, and some of them were killed at the time. And they also, just like journalists, were clearly wearing their paramedic uniform. It was very obvious that they were paramedics, that they posed no threat to any Israeli soldier. And yet they were shot dead as well. There was one young lady, a paramedic, who was killed at that time. I can't recall her name. But again, it's just a pattern that continues with the Israelis.
Yeah, well, and that was Razan Ashraf al-Najjar, the young woman, 21 years of age, wearing medical scrubs and deliberately shot dead. And to tell you the truth, that's what really struck me when I saw this. Well, I didn't watch the video. I couldn't. I just saw the still frame of Ahmed al-Jaoub being shot yesterday. But the first thing that struck me at that, when reading the description of it, was Razan, who was a medical professional who was shot down aiding people that were wounded on the ground. That's what she was doing when she was shot during the Great March of Return in 2018.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that. Yes.
This idea that journalists and medics are not only targets that are legitimate in the eyes of the Israeli military, but are targets of opportunity. There's a program, a plan behind doing that. It becomes apparent when I was watching your film, and when the attack on the Mavi Marmara began, it seemed to me by watching your film that it was just those people, especially people with cameras, as you had a camera yourself, that were targeted. Is that a fair assumption to say that people with cameras and people that look to be in positions of authority and organizing the mayhem that ensued during the attack were targeted first?
Absolutely. I agree with that statement 100%, because the reason is very simple. The Israelis don't want the truth to come out. If they had no problem with the truth, they wouldn't be targeting all these journalists or people who are carrying cameras and trying to document what's taking place. What happened with us on the Freedom Flotilla, specifically on the Mavi Marmara ship, which I was on, is that the first action that the Israelis tried to do was block the frequency that we were broadcasting with from the ship. We had many journalists on the ship. We were broadcasting what was taking place. And even as the attack began, we continued to broadcast. The Israeli authorities attempted to block our frequency. But luckily, the organizers did have a backup frequency that they switched to, and they were able to continue broadcasting the attack to the world. But that didn't also prevent the Israelis from stopping what they were doing. They continued their attack, and they continued to attack journalists as well. We had one photojournalist with us. His name was, a number of journalists with us, but one of them was a photojournalist. His name was Jawdat Kilichlar, and he was carrying a camera during the attack. It was very clear that it was a camera. yet he was shot dead between the eyes. He was one of 10 people who were killed on the Mavi Marmara. And a friend of mine, actually, a journalist from Jordan, he was shot as well, even though he was clearly wearing a vest that indicated that he was a journalist. So, yes, I believe that the Israeli army deliberately targets journalists because they don't want the truth to come out. And interestingly enough, when they got a hold of me after they got full control of the ship, and they basically attacked me, they threw me to the ground. And one of the first things that they asked me, or rather the only thing that they asked me, was, where is your mobile phone? And it was a little surprising, because out of everything that they could have asked me, they asked me about my phone. They didn't want my recording device to stay in my possession.
Yeah, you know, when I first contacted you, I mentioned that I knew Kevin Nisch, and I've interviewed him many times over the years. And Kevin was a shipmate on that ill-fated voyage on the Mavi Marmara, who was recording with his device, but managed to take out the memory chip and secrete it. So he handed over his device, but kept footage that he had shot of that night and what was going on. I was curious, watching your film, how you managed to get the footage that you use in The Truth Lost at Sea. And did you use some of Kevin's as well?
Well, it was a combination of things, actually. Yes, I did use some still photos that Kevin managed to smuggle out from the ship. And I also used video footage that was smuggled off the ship by the Cultures of Resistance organization. They were able to smuggle quite a bit of footage of the attack from the ship, and eventually they were able to play that at the UN, that footage at the UN. In addition to that, I got lucky with some of the footage that I recorded. What happened was that before the attack, I had recorded about 10 cassette tapes at the time. I was using those small cassette tapes, and I was able to record 10 cassette tapes, and they were all in my bag. This was prior to the attack. Yet after the attack took place, and after they confiscated all of our devices and all the footage that they could get their hands on, when I was reunited with my suitcase, let us say, I went and I opened it up just to see if my cassettes were still there. And out of the 10 cassettes that were there of footage recorded prior to the attack, there were only two or three left. So it seems that they missed those. It seems that they were in another pocket. And I was able to use that footage as well in the film. And that was never before seen footage of what was taking place prior to the attack.
And it's really moving. And maybe you can describe it. I wouldn't say festive, the mood of the participants as they're getting ready to set sail and in the final leg of the Mavi's journey, but it was upbeat, and the crew the people taking part, it was such a cross section of people with, you know, varied interests and varied accomplishments. Perhaps we should describe Rifat, the ship, the Mavi Marmara itself, and the complement that was on it as you set sail before encountering Israel's military.
Yeah, well, like you said, I mean, festive is a good word or a good adjective to describe the atmosphere that we had on the ship. I mean, really, we had been a part of this event, and it really was historic, because what we had here on the Freedom Flotilla, we had citizens from dozens of countries, literally dozens of countries. I think the exact number ranged between 35 to 40 countries who were participating in this initiative. Many of them were on the Mavi Marmara because it was the biggest ship. The Mavi Marmara had close to about 600 passengers. And the entire time, we were all hopeful, and we really believed that we would reach Gaza with the humanitarian aid that we were taking with us. And so it was a really upbeat atmosphere. Everybody was, you know, meeting people from other countries, other cultures. It was like one big family in the sea, and everybody became very close to each other quite quickly. And then, of course, all of that changed after the attack. We, as passengers, were not expecting the Israelis to attack us in the way that they did and with such lethal force, because it was obvious that it was a humanitarian mission, that we carried no weapons whatsoever. And we had so many journalists with us on board, and people from human rights organizations and other such types of organizations, that we did not expect the Israelis to attack us at all. So, you know, the atmosphere was upbeat the whole time, all the way up till a few hours before the attack, when the threats started to become much more serious and we started seeing the Israeli vessels in the distance.
Yeah, let's talk about that. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Rifat Audeh. Rifat is a longtime activist. He's a defender of Palestinian human rights, a Palestinian Canadian himself. As he mentioned, he studied engineering and media and journalism in Great Britain. His articles are published across the internet in English and Arabic too. Rifat was aboard, as he says, the Mavi Marmara that night. And we're talking today around his film, The Truth Lost at Sea, the documentary that you put out in 2018, and you won a slew of awards.
I did release it around 2017, 2018. It participated in about 28 or 29 international film festivals, and it won about 8 awards. Actually, the Israelis were very, I don't know if I want to use the word intelligent or diabolic about how they went about with their media strategy. But in all honesty, it was quite smart, because what they did is they held us incommunicado. After they took control of the ship, they basically kidnapped us and threw us in an Israeli prison without any contact to the outside world. Now, once they did that, everybody in the world who saw the images being broadcast on our backup frequency had no choice but to follow up on the story with whoever they could. Well, there are two sides to the story, our side and the Israeli side. But our side was thrown in jail by the Israeli side without any contact with the outside world. So the only option that remained available for media outlets and officials around the world to follow up on, the only option that they could follow up on, was to tap into the Israeli story and ask Israeli officials what happened. And so the Israeli officials now had free rein to tell their side of the story to media outlets around the world. And we couldn't refute that because we were in prison and they weren't allowing us to contact anybody in the outside world. And so this is something that they tried to succeed in. But luckily, once we were out and we were able to contact other media outlets and, you know, create films such as the one that I did, then the narrative started to change. I mean, people started to see what really happened on that ship.
Well, and the fact that some of the footage, like your found cassettes and Kevin's memory chip, and footage from some of the other boats in the flotilla, because we must remember that it wasn't just the Mavi Marmara. There were other ships in this flotilla that were attacked, not in the same manner, of course, as the Mavi Marmara was, but brutally. And they as well went through the same thing, having their communication devices and cameras and everything smashed and stolen, and footage taken. But still somehow images and video survived to tell the story that the after the fact the Israelis were busy spinning against as well.
Yeah, and I try to highlight the fact that you mentioned is that they were quite brutal on all of the other ships as well, the smaller ships that were with us. They did not employ lethal force on those ships, but the passengers on those other ships were beaten. They were taken to prison just the same we were. They were abused in different ways. So yeah, the Israeli actions basically were prevalent on all of the vessels of the Freedom Flotilla.
describe what happened as night fell and this attack began, because again, the Israeli story was entirely different from the story of the people of your film and others. What happened when they moved in?
Well, prior to the attack, we kept receiving threats from the Israeli side. And these threats were announcements made in various media outlets, statements made by officials, and so on. We started to get worried, but even at that point, we did not think that they would attack us the way they did. Now, as night started to fall, we began seeing some Israeli vessels in the distance, military vessels. And there were like drones, I believe, that were flying overhead. And what happened prior to the attack is that the organizers on the ship requested that everybody put on life vests just in case, because we didn't know what was going to happen. So at the time of the attack, we were all wearing life vests. And during this time, all the way up until the hours, up until the attack, during the hours leading up to the attack, we continued to broadcast. And we continued to ask the world to, keep following the flotilla, because we felt that an attack had become imminent. At about 4:30 a.m. is when they timed their attack. And they attacked us basically when many people on the ship, I'd say hundreds of people, were doing their morning prayers, the Muslim morning Fajr prayer. So they attacked the ship at the time of prayers itself. And they started attacking us with Zodiac boats. They came on small speed boats, these small Zodiac boats. And they first tried to board the ship from these Zodiac boats. We tried to resist their boarding of the ship by basically throwing things at these little Zodiac boats and putting water hoses over the rails and spraying them with these water hoses in order to prevent them from boarding the ship. After that, they came to the ship with helicopters, and they had commandos rappelling down from helicopters onto the top deck of the ship. And I should note here that the UN Human Rights Council fact-finding mission report stated that even before they came onto the ship from the helicopter, they were shooting at the ship with live ammunition. So they rappelled down, the commandos rappelled down onto the top deck of the ship, and they were firing the whole time at us. There were stun grenades, there was live bullets, there were plastic bullets. As I had mentioned, about 9 people lost their lives that night, and a 10th died later due to his injuries after being in a coma for 3 to 4 years. And so it was a very difficult situation that we were in. We tried to resist their boarding of the ship with whatever we could. So we had sticks. We actually cut the railing. We were so desperate that we cut the railing of the ship, the side of the ship, and we tried to defend ourselves with that, using those as sticks. Now, some people might think that's silly, because what are sticks going to do against live ammunition? But if anything, it shows how desperate we were to defend ourselves, because we need to keep in mind also that there were elderly people on that ship. There were families on that ship. There were young children on that ship as well. So we were trying to defend ourselves as best as we could. After they took control of the ship, it was about 40 minutes till they took complete control of the ship. And after that, what they did is they restrained us. They basically tied us up with plastic straps. Some people were tied in the front. Their hands were tied in the front. Others were tied in the back. Some of us were blindfolded. Some of us were not. Many of us were prevented from going to the washroom the entire time they had control of the ship. Unfortunately, some people were even forced to urinate on themselves. We were pretty much prevented from any food or water for that duration while they had control of the ship. And then they took the ship to a port, and they took us after that to a prison.
It's a disturbing film, to say the least, and it's been such a long time. I found that even I who have done a lot of stories over the years and intervening years on what goes on in Palestine, I'd forgotten, and the visceral outrage that I felt was again as it always has been from the very beginning. Your website is truthlostatsea.com. How do people, Rifat, go about viewing your film?
Sure. Well, they could find a link to the film on my website. That will take them to my distributor's website there. And they could basically order the film online there. And on my distributor's website, it shows that the film is available on numerous platforms like Google Play, Amazon, probably one or two more, but they're all there on my distributor's website, which is Journeyman Pictures. So once they go to truthlostatsea.com, they'll see the link, and it's pretty self-explanatory. And people can also order the film for public screenings if they'd like. And basically, I could attend any public screening, either in person or online, if any organizer wishes to have me on there to have Q&A sessions with the audience after the film. And I've been doing that extensively. I've done that dozens of times so far, either in Europe or here in North America.
Well, and as you said too, there's a slew of awards for this documentary, and I'm looking at some of the testimonials on your website from Norman Finkelstein and Roger Waters, among them, Ian Pape. It's a fantastic and disturbing film, as it was a treacherous act of piracy and murder when it was committed, and even worse, that the people of Gaza are still locked behind their open-air prison with no release in sight, the sea cut off to them, and their fishermen. We could read every day more attacks against Palestinians, both in Gaza and now the West Bank, who I read on Al Jazeera, there's been more fatalities in the West Bank this year already than in the last almost 20 years. It's been the highest rate of fatalities, and more to come, as we see an Israeli woman shot the other day, and things are escalating there again. But thanks a lot, Rifat, for your film and your long dedication to a cause I know you can't divorce yourself from.
Yeah, no, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you on your show, and I hope people can indeed check out the film, or at least check the trailer online at truthlostatsea.com. And also, I want to point out that on my website, they can contact me directly if they have any questions or would like to organize any screening, either through me directly or through my distributor.
Yeah, we can't let these things be forgotten. Well, thanks again, Rifat. And I want everyone else to stay tuned, because I'm going to speak with Molly Murphy on the in the next segment. We're going to talk again about Ferry Creek. Arrests were made again last week. These on top of the 1,200 that were arrested last year, trying to stop the logging of the old growth forests here on Vancouver Island. And the logging continues. So stay tuned for that. Thanks again, Rifat.
Thank you.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, the struggle to save what remains of first growth forests on Vancouver Island continues. The 2021-22 partial blockade of timber company Teal Jones at Ferry Creek in the Cowichan region resumed late last month. And last week, three more defenders joined the 1,200 arrested last year trying to stop logging there. The arrests bring the issue back into public consciousness, even as the trees continue to fall Molly Murphy is a BIPOC activist, journalist, researcher, and social justice warrior. She's one of the 1,200 people arrested at the Ferry Creek protests last year and continues to, quote, fight against the systems of oppression and supporting those who strive to do the same. Molly's also a builder, mother of three, and co-author of the Mud Girls Manifesto.